The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 30th, 2017. It's a special year-end edition in which we set up a voicemail box and solicited your questions. You asked them, and we are here in the Jungle Studio answering them. I am here with Susan Hennessy, Lawfare's esteemed executive editor, and we are dragooning other Lawfare contributors in as need be to address the questions you guys asked. We got quite a few. Some were unintelligible. We're excluding those. Some were off topic. We're excluding those. None were offensive. So we are just going to get right to it and address them in order. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 272, Lawfare Questions. I think we are ready for question number one.
Yeah, hi. My name is Andrew. I wanted to ask about the status of forces agreement between the U.S. and Iraq, which doesn't exist. I'm wondering how it ought to be viewed in hindsight. In 2011, the Pentagon, the Obama administration, cited the Parliament's failure to approve a status of forces agreement as a primary reason for the full withdrawal. And then, U.S. troops have been back in the country for almost 3 years now without a status of forces agreement. I'm wondering if that's an exposure of vulnerability for U.S. troops there today, or whether, in hindsight, we should view that explanation back in 2011 as somewhat of a political cover for the withdrawal. If anybody has any thoughts on that, I look forward to hearing it. Thanks. Bye.
Well, I have the perfect person to answer that question. Scott Anderson, our new Brookings colleague, whose name you guys have seen on Lawfare a lot recently. Scott is served as legal attaché at the embassy in Baghdad for the State Department in an earlier life, and knows a great deal about this subject. So, Scott, welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. What are your thoughts?
Well, thank you for having me, Ben. I'm a little limited to certain parts of this I can talk about because of my time in government, but I'll try and give you at least my perspective on the broad issue. To think about this, I think you really have to put yourself in the 2011 context. At that point, we had been under a security agreement, or the SOFA, as Andrew referred to it, with Iraq for 3 years. During that period, it had been fairly controversial and had been getting more controversial. And that was particularly true among big portions of the Shia factions that were behind Prime Minister Maliki and in control of most of the government at that period. And so really, if you think about the trouble that any sort of follow-on agreement ran into in the Iraqi parliament, a lot of that was more symptomatic of a broader controversy surrounding the U.S. troop presence in the country at that time that had been growing and was becoming more problematic. This was also occurring against a backdrop where the original agreement had a finite end date and without any sort of provision for extension. This is the post-surge period where Iraq had been seeing its security conditions kind of improve gradually. These circumstances all kind of entered in, I think, into this policy decision. 2013, meanwhile, when we saw U.S. troops re-enter Iraq, we saw a dramatic change in circumstances. You saw an escalation of threat from the Islamic State. You saw requests from Iraq for assistance in combating the Islamic State and addressing this threat. One thing that, you know, you may didn't mention, Andrew, but, you know, U.S. officials at the time reported out to the media that they, in fact, had gotten assurances regarding legal protections for U.S. troops, which was one of the key points in the SOFA, or security agreement, follow-on arrangement. So there were some arrangements in place there. And, you know, it's a different type of military mission than was being anticipated in the initial place, or pardon me, in the initial follow-on presence, in that this was a smaller deployment intended to assist Iraqi forces in combating the Islamic State. So there are all different factors that entered into these different decisions. I don't think that that means that there isn't room to criticize the Obama administration, either for its positions in 2011 or for its actions in 2013. There's lots to be talked about there. But to paint the security agreement discussion as simply some sort of political cover, I don't think is entirely accurate. Instead, it was one piece of a much larger puzzle around Iraq policy in 2011, and many of those pieces changed between then and 2013 that led to the way the Obama administration adjusted its position.
All right, next question.
Hey, this is Melissa from Washington State. This question is for Ben Wittes in particular, but really for all of you. Over the last 2 years, Lawfare has gone from being a relatively niche national security law blog to a nationally recognized source of nonpartisan and, let's call it, reality-based commentary on the Trump administration. How do you feel about that, and what challenges does it present?
Wow, so that's a really complicated question, and I have really complicated and, frankly, mixed feelings about it. So on the one hand, you get into business like this because you want to do stuff that's useful. And there's something incredibly gratifying about the fact that large numbers of people who were never the target audience for Lawfare find it compelling and useful. And we really, I think I speak for all of us, couldn't be more delighted and grateful that, you know, large numbers of people are consulting the site every day, using the site and learning from it, and find this group of people that we assembled for reasons having nothing to do with Donald Trump a useful sounding board for thinking about how to think about life in Donald Trump's America. It is one of the weird ironies that a group of people that we assembled for expertise on things like the law of war, surveillance law, Guantanamo, drone strikes, turns out to be exactly the sort of person, group of people that you would want to hear from about a presidency. But that does seem to be the case. And we kind of couldn't be more pleased by that. There is another side, though, that's complicated, which is that, you know, we do have this core readership that we're very committed to serving. And so the question of how you sort of serve this very large new readership that has come in while also keeping faith with the traditional readership that uses Lawfare for, you know, sometimes very technical matters that are really important to that readership, but, you know, not necessarily important to a broader readership, and how to integrate those things in a fashion that is useful is a real challenge, and something that, you know, we've struggled with collectively, and I've certainly struggled with personally. There are things that our traditional readership doesn't need that the new readership very much does need, some things that we do in the form of kind of explainers on basic areas of law that is just sort of not traditionally what we've done. And so how to figure out what the right balance that gives this very large new readership what it's looking for while also keeping faith with the readership that we designed Lawfare for and made Lawfare what it is something that, you know, is an ongoing work in progress and we're very committed to, and we're very interested in whether we're doing it well or how we could be doing it better.
Yeah, so I, you know, agree with everything Ben just said. I think my sort of view of it is that nothing about what lawfare is or what we do has necessarily changed, right? So we're still, you know, we're having an interesting conversation among sort of experts, that core, I guess, original audience, and we're delighted that more and more people are finding it sort of interesting and useful. What is really different now is there are a number of issues that are sort of, we now view as being within our issue set that we didn't used to. So one is sort of immigration. That's not really something we'd thought of as a national security issue, just because of sort of the specific ways that had occupied the conversation previously. You know, obviously it's a much more sort of central conversation now. You know, there are any number of sort of issues like that. You can think about ethics and transparency issues, obviously the special counsel investigation. And so sort of the national security conversation has moved, and I think it's moved in a way that is resonant with larger groups of people, but the way we approach those issues with sort of, you know, in the weeds, detailed text-based analysis. I think that's what we do well, what we've always done well, and it's the reason why people, you know, are so attracted to lawfare. So I think it's sort of our plan is to keep doing that, keep trying to do that, you know, to get better and better, to cover those issues with sort of greater density, and just to let kind of the national security and sort of the broader, you know, sort of national security debate, you know, lead the issues that we're covering.
All right. Next question.
This is a message for, or a question for Ben. Ben, my name is Neil. I'm in Seattle. And I'm sort of concerned about what happens next if the GOP sort of acquiesces and they fire Mueller and Rosenstein and, you know, essentially bring the investigation to a halt, at least on the surface. So my question is, what happens after that? You know, my guess is that there's a whole FBI bureaucracy that is filled with, you know, well-meaning patriots who take their job seriously and would continue to pursue an investigation under the statutory requirements of the FBI to investigate crime. But like, will indictments be unsealed? Will there be further indictments? Like, what happens? I guess that's my question. Thank you. Love your podcast.
Thanks for the question. So, look, this is a huge black box. And one of the reasons that we people should be so concerned about firing Bob Mueller or removing the senior leadership of the Justice Department is because we don't actually know what would happen afterwards. So there's a few possibilities. First of all, you have to consider what Congress's reaction would be to that. There was a lot of pushback from Republicans in the Senate when the president floated the idea of firing the Attorney General earlier in the summer. So one possibility, depending on how it's done or when it's done or under what circumstances, is that you would have a very substantial congressional pushback. Second possibility, of course, is that it would influence electoral considerations in a fashion that it wouldn't have an immediate congressional pushback, but it would help cause changes in power in Congress in a fashion that then would have a longer term congressional pushback if, for example, Republicans lost control of one or both houses of Congress. Within the executive branch, it matters a great deal exactly what happened. So if you just fired Bob Mueller but didn't get rid of his office, you know, the impact of firing Archibald Cox was replacing him with Leon Jaworski and the business of the office during Watergate, and the business of the Watergate Special Prosecution Force basically went on throughout that. So if you replace Bob Mueller with somebody else, then the question becomes, well, is that person a better leader or a less good leader than Bob Mueller? But you could imagine the work of the office continuing through that. If, on the other hand, you obliterated the office itself, that is a much more consequential thing. Then the question becomes which parts of the investigation get terminated, which parts get absorbed into what parts of the Justice Department, And, you know, all of that is a very fact-specific set of questions. And I think we don't know the answer to it prospectively. We won't know until it happens. We should all be vigilant about making sure it does not happen, because it would be a very, very dark day for the Republic.
My question is directed at, though you might have trouble getting her, Tamara Kaufman Wittes. Good luck if you do find her. Can you please ask that in September of last year, we were having reports of ISIS being in retreat. Either their revenues were dwindling or the likelihood of their caliphate was reducing in size. So my question is this. If we are making success at pushing ISIS and reducing their forces now, was it likely that no matter who won, either Donald Trump or Hillary, the person in question, so long as they are competent, running the Department of Defense, likely that they would have succeeded in pushing and making more irrelevant the Islamic State now as we enter 2018. Love the show. Sorry if I've jumbled the question. Thanks.
So Tamara Kaufman Wittes is not, in fact, formally a Lawfare contributor, though she is a member of the Rational Security team. But through the magic of Brookings and the Wittes marriage, we happen to have her right here, and she can answer this question.
Well, wow. Thanks for having me on the Lawfare podcast. This is unprecedented. And thanks for the question. And I think it is a good opportunity to kind of look back at where we were in the fight against ISIS and where we are now. You'll recall that President Obama, having fully withdrawn American forces, combat forces from Iraq at the end of 2011, then reinserted American forces into Iraq and eventually also into Syria, beginning in the summer of 2014, to deal with this resurgent threat from ISIS. And, you know, I think this was something he did against his own inclinations, but because it was clear that the ISIS threat was growing. It was a threat not only to Iraq and the success of our efforts to stabilize Iraq, but also to the region as a whole and farther afield, that ISIS was using its base in Iraq and Syria to gain revenue, to attract foreign fighters, to conduct long-range attack planning and recruiting. And to do a lot of propaganda activity, which increased the possibility for long-distance radicalization, which is the threat we continue to see both here and in Europe. So, look, I think that by the time Obama left office, that ISIS fight was well along. And in Iraq, the primary forces fighting ISIS were, in fact, Iraqi forces. They were doing so with air support from the United States and the UK and the Australians and others. And they were doing so with a lot of kind of advice and assistance from the United States. But the Iraqi counterterrorism force was bearing the brunt of the fighting as that coalition made its way to the outskirts of Mosul. And they were taking heavy, heavy losses throughout the battle for Mosul. In Syria, it took the United States a little while to assemble a coalition of local forces that could be effective in pushing ISIS out of the territory it held in Syria. And those forces are primarily led by Syrian Kurdish militias, which sort of beg the question of how the United States would relate its war against ISIS to the broader question of who would control what parts of Syria after the civil war there concluded. So I think it's fair to say that by the end of the Obama administration, there was a lot of momentum. The coalition fighting ISIS actually was holding back from an all-out assault on Mosul at the end of the Obama administration and kind of waiting to wear them down a bit. And Trump did accelerate somewhat the campaign. He increased the number of American forces in the field. He loosened up rules of engagement and targeting constraints. But the direction was clearly set. And I think you're right that no matter who was president, we would have eventually seen the most powerful military in the world overcome a ragtag bunch of insurgents. But of course, getting ISIS out of its territorial base does not defeat ISIS. It's now turning into a sort of submerged insurgency movement, and that's going to be a long-term challenge.
Scott Anderson, do you have additional thoughts on this?
Well, I think I agree mostly with what Tammy said, which is this idea that this is the culmination of a plan that's been in place. And I do think it's worth noting that a lot of the leadership folks in terms of the counter-ISIL coalition on the U.S. side has stayed constant. Brett McGurk, who's the special envoy for the counter-ISIL coalition at the end of the Obama administration, has remained constant and is still in that position under the Trump administration. You know, certainly there is an argument to be made that particularly the lowering of the rules of engagement and the increasing of the military presence in Iraq and Syria may have escalated or, expedited the fall of ISIS, and particularly around Mosul, and that's a good thing in certain ways. There are also going to be costs to that we're going to see moving forward. There's been a lot of coverage about the civilian costs of particularly the Mosul offensive and the broader counter-ISIL campaign, and we're really only beginning to get an understanding of what that is and how that may have changed under the policies of the two administrations and different commanders in the field who've been devolved more authority by the Trump administration, so it seems, at least. So it's hard to know for sure. I think it's a question for future historians in a way to see exactly the role that the Trump administration's unique policy changes may have had. But certainly the general momentum and trajectory was going against ISIS from, certainly the end of the Obama administration, probably, pretty far off from the end of the Obama administration once the coalition was in place and actions started being coordinated against them.
Thanks, guys. Okay, next question.
Hi, this is Miles from Crown Point, Indiana, and my question is for Josh Blackman. So now that Mike Flynn is cooperating with the FBI and he has pled guilty to lying to the FBI, which is a felony, if it comes out that he told Trump about this and Trump didn't report it, could he be liable for being charged with the misprision of a felony? And if so, is that too small of a charge for someone like Mueller to actually bring up?
This is Josh Blackman. 18 U.S.C. 4 provides that whoever having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States conceals and does not as soon as possible make known the same to the some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. I had originally addressed a related question in my early draft of Part 3 on the President and Obstruction of Justice, but cut it for space constraints. You're welcome, Ben. So I appreciate the opportunity to address it here. It is difficult to extend the misprision of felony statute to the president because the president has the ultimate authority for who is and is not charged with a crime through his removal power of the attorney general. Following up from my analysis in Part 3, Trump may have determined that referring Flynn for an investigation and the resulting prosecution would inflict undue costs on the administration's foreign policy agenda. Trump could have determined that Flynn's resignation settled the matter and no further actions were needed. In other words, Trump knew what the investigation would ultimately yield. Indeed, Flynn's guilty plea confirms it, so there was no need to prolong the matter. That is why, to buck the conventional wisdom, I don't think John Dowd's tweets about Trump knowing Flynn lied were so stupid. What I suspect Trump's lawyers were trying to convey is that the president considered Flynn's lies, determined that the resignation settled the matter, and that Comey's ongoing investigation was unnecessary. Thank you for the question, and I look forward to another year of writing for Lawfare.
Okay, next question.
Hello, my name is Grant Dasher, and I'm a longtime Google software engineer who works on cybersecurity issues. I also briefly served in the Obama administration. My question is for Susan. It seems to me that the national security policy community and the Silicon Valley community come at cybersecurity issues with radically different priors and some non-trivial mutual distrust. Personally, I think the fault for this lies on both sides, but it seems to me that this is inhibiting our nation's effectiveness in this area going forward. My question is in three parts. A, do you agree that this is a problem? B, If so, do you think this is a U.S.-specific phenomenon? My personal sense is yes. Or do you think it's shared by other actors, for example, China, Russia, or Europe? And C, again, if so, what do you think can be done to build a more productive relationship going forward?
I would just like to start by pointing out, before I turn it over to Susan, that that is a model of how you leave a voicemail question for a podcast. And I want to extend my personal congratulations to the questioner for a near pitch perfect podcast question. Susan, over to you.
Well done, Grant. So I certainly agree with you that sort of the gulf that we see between sort of the Washington, D.C. policy community and Silicon Valley in general is not a tremendously productive thing. There are some areas in which that's more evident than others. We can look at sort of the encryption fight being one area where it's particularly entrenched and counterproductive. You know, there are other areas related to sort of cross-border data policy where I think that there is more cooperation that's going on and more productive and somewhat quiet cooperation happening. In terms of whether or not it's a U.S.-specific phenomenon, I don't know that it's U.S. only. That said, some of the other, you mentioned Russia and China. I don't know that it is the same type of issues for those countries, particularly in China. There is an intimacy and an overlap between their private industries and their governments. There is a significantly larger degree of sort of control there. And in some ways, that is an advantage for those countries, and in the sense that they don't necessarily have to go through the same sort of policy and compromise process, and their interests are not necessarily not aligned in the same way that exists in the United States. That said, our sort of landscape does look broadly like, you know, it looks in Europe. One sort of interesting outlier is potentially Israel, an area in which, because of their mandatory military service, a lot of individuals who are sort of leaders in their tech sector previously served in the military, previously served in their signals intelligence units, and therefore there is a lot of sort of cooperation and collaboration between those groups. Obviously, though, countries are much smaller and have really different interests. Finally, in terms of what can be done to build a more productive relationship moving forward, there are a lot of interesting ideas about sort of inviting people from Silicon Valley into the instance in government, trying to have more of that cross-pollination. At the end of the day, we currently ask our technology sector to play a quasi-sovereign role and to make a lot of decisions that ordinarily are made by governments, right? Whether or not they should be complying with foreign data requests, for example. And so while we need to have full participation from sort of the relevant stakeholders in these conversations, I do think that the sort of the pendulum has swung too far. We're asking too much of companies. And really what we need to do is have the U.S. government sort of reoccupy that role, make the hard decisions, try and understand sort of what the will of the American people are, and provide some degree of certainty, especially for our multinational corporations. I actually think that sort of taking a little bit of a stronger stand up front might sort of smooth the way for a more productive relationship overall.
Thanks, Susan. Let's go to the next question.
Hello, this is Richard Willey calling with a question for Ben. When will people start paying attention to the real Mueller investigation? I'm specifically referring to allegations surrounding criminal money laundering by the Trump Organization. Collusion with Russia has always seemed much too nebulous a charge for any kind of successful prosecution. Moreover, given the current political climate, I don't believe that it would be possible to bring forth a successful prosecution for obstruction of justice. However, money laundering, and in particular money laundering that involved the Iranian National Guard, South American drug cartels, and Russian oligarchs, really feels like a whole different kettle of fish. Equally significant, many of these crimes could be prosecuted, say, by the state of New York. So even if Mueller weren't able to get sufficient traction at the federal level, it's still very likely to take down Trump. So why is this aspect of the investigation getting so little attention, both by the conventional press and by your podcast?
Okay, there are at least three assumptions embedded in that question that I want to surface. One is that there are no prosecutions to bring on the basis of Trump-Russia connections. The second is that there are no prosecutions to bring based on obstruction. And the third is that there is some reservoir of prosecutable cases based on money laundering. I don't know any of those assumptions to be correct. The collusion stuff is a matter of active investigation and has produced two criminal pleas, both by George Papadopoulos and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. On false statements ground, both of them, but both about interactions with Russia. So I assume that is a matter of active investigation that may or may not come to fruition in a significant way, but I certainly wouldn't take as a working assumption that is not the locus. You know, when you say the real Mueller investigation, I assume that the real Mueller investigation is centrally about the matter at the core of his jurisdiction, which is the relationship between the president's campaign and foreign actors. The second assumption, which I don't know how to evaluate, is that there are no prosecutable cases to be made on the basis of obstruction of justice. That's a very complicated, fact-specific area. There is clearly an active investigation of it by Mueller's people. I have said publicly, and I stand by, that it would be a very difficult case to make. But the fact that they're investigating it actively makes me not at all confident that your premise is correct. The third component, which, there is two reasons to think that you may be right, that there's a serious set of money laundering questions. One is that Paul Manafort and Rick Gates were indicted for, among other things, money laundering, and that was sort of the cornerstone of their indictment. And the second element is that there are these a number of very large transactions involving the Trump Organization and people associated with the Trump campaign and foreign money actors that a lot of press has dealt with how suspicious we should be of these transactions. And in particular, Adam Davidson at The New Yorker has done some really, really interesting work on some Central Asia transactions. So I take the money laundering component seriously, but it's quite tentative. And there have not been, with the exception of the Manafort-Gates indictment, it has not been a central locus of the public work of the Mueller investigation. And so I think the answer to your question is the reason press and people like us have not focused on it as intensively is that is not what publicly the Mueller investigation is most obviously doing. That could change, and certainly lots of people have their eye on it and are very interested in it. But I think the real Mueller investigation is, at least as defined by the activity of the Mueller investigation, is focused on other things. All right, next question.
Hello, this is Mike from League City, Texas. This question is mainly for Benjamin. The question is this. Based on all the contacts and all the meetings and the proposed meetings and the cozy relationship of Putin and Trump, or the way they interact with each other, I'm curious to why do you think that we won't find anything that will tie Trump, as they say, collusion with Putin?
So I'm not sure why the question assumes that I think we will not. I have not said actually what I think we will find, not because I'm being coy, but because I genuinely don't know. And I genuinely don't know at least three things. One is what the truth is. The second is what will be provable about that truth. And the third is whether that truth, if the truth is that there was some measure of collusion, whether that will be a collusion of a variety that would violate the law, or whether it would simply be something that would look awful. And so I have not prejudged, even in my own mind, let alone publicly, the outcome of the investigation. I think there are a bunch of questions that I would like answers to, both as a, you know, as a criminal law enforcement matter, as a counterintelligence matter, and frankly, as a public policy matter. You know, I think Congress should get to the bottom of some of these questions. But I actually don't have an especially strong working theory about what the answer is, and I'm certainly not predicting what we will or won't find. All right, next question.
Hello, I have a question for the Lawfare podcast. I have a question I'd like to ask Benjamin or any of your contributors who might want to answer. My question has to do with presidential pardons. If President Trump pardons anyone involved in the Robert Mueller investigation, my understanding is that they can no longer incriminate themselves, but they could be compelled to testify against others. If they don't, they could be charged with contempt of court. But my question is, could the president then also pardon them for that? So they really can't end up in trouble. I know the political damage may be done at that point, but I just like to understand what he can and cannot do in legal terms.
Okay, so first of all, I'm not a criminal law expert, and the boundaries of the pardon power are, at least at the margins, a little bit disputed, but generally speaking, it's exceptionally broad. And so the answer to your question is, I think, relatively simple, which is that the president can pardon whomever he wants. At that point, they can still be compelled to testify, and they can no longer assert the Fifth Amendment over anything that they would be pardoned for. It, as you point out, if they refuse, they can be held in contempt. Now, contempt has two elements, right? There's civil contempt, which is a coercive mechanism available to the court, and there's criminal contempt, which is when you're then prosecuted for the contempt, right? The president can certainly pardon somebody for a criminal contempt. There is, you know, that's absolutely within his power to do. And you could imagine a cyclical, you know, an endless circle of pardons and compulsions, right? You must testify. I refuse to testify. The president, you're held in contempt. The president pardons you. And that going on over and over and over again ad infinitum. The interesting question, to which I do not know the answer, is whether the president could pardon somebody for a civil contempt. And I think the answer is probably not. And so the question, and I'd be very interested from our criminal law listeners, whether if you had somebody who a court held in civil contempt to force them to testify, and the president tried to use the pardon power in that context, I think that would not be effective. And so the interesting question is, how robust would that civil contempt proceeding or finding be? I, again, as with all of these things, we need to hope and that it never comes to this sort of thing. But these academic questions have a way of becoming less academic the more embattled a criminal subject in a major investigation gets when he wields, say, the power to fire his prosecutor or the power to pardon all the subjects of the investigation.
So one additional point that I think is probably worth making in this context is, as part of Flynn's cooperation agreement, he certainly sat down with the prosecutors to proffer what he knows, right? So he wrote a sworn affidavit, he gave a recorded statement, right? He basically has already told Mueller in some form that has been memorialized basically everything that he knows. So even if you were faced with a situation in which Flynn refused to actually testify, there are probably a number of different options for the prosecution to at least use the information or materials that Flynn has already provided. And so that's why this might sort of be more of a hypothetical than anything, because even if it was sort of, Trump was inclined to pardon him for the contempt and Flynn was inclined to not want to testify, the prosecutors at this point might have alternative ways of introducing that testimony or that evidence into a court proceeding.
Finally, here is one final, very broad question.
Hi, this question is for everybody on the podcast, and it may seem simple, but I'd like to hear what you think. What, if anything, are we doing in the Middle East? Thank you.
All right. Tamara, Scott, I'm just going to turn this one over to you guys. What, if anything, are we doing in the Middle East?
What aren't we doing in the Middle East, Scott? Let's see. We are engaged in combat in at least two countries. We're engaged in non-combat counterterrorism operations in more countries. We sell a lot of arms to many countries. We have ongoing military and economic assistance to about a half dozen countries. What am I missing? We trade.
Well, I think it's a fair question to say that there's a lot going on in the Middle East this year. When I look at it, it strikes me that kind of the culmination of a couple trends. I'd be curious about your views on this, Tammy. This is the way at least I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and that we see kind of three big issues driving affairs in the Middle East, a lot of which have kind of come to the fore as to what the primary concerns are for the states there. The one for the last several years has been the counter-ISIL effort, certainly from the United States perspective. And there's been a fair amount of unity among a lot of the countries in the region in that effort. But as that effort has kind of waned and as the Islamic State has begun to recede, it seems like we have two other issues that have really come to the fore. One is concerns regarding Iran and Iran's ability to exercise influence in the region, which seems to become a major driver of many more states, particularly Saudi Arabia and its allies in Egypt and the UAE's foreign policy, certainly over the last year, arguably a little bit much longer than that. And the other issue is that also this kind of faction you see among Sunni states, among states that have a lot of concerns regarding a kind of populist Islamic forms of government often associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and those that are more open to them. So I'm thinking here about the divide between Qatar and the rest of the GCC, not the entire rest of the GCC, Qatar and the UAE and Saudi Arabia, certainly. And what's kind of interesting is that you've seen a lot of fronts on both of those, primarily driven by Saudi Arabia with this kind of more robust foreign policy, trying to push on both of those fronts at once. And I think it's led to kind of two kind of interesting developments. One, you see kind of emergence of new sorts of relationships that 2 or 3 years ago didn't make a lot of sense, such as between Qatar and Turkey and Iran, mostly because they're in the among those two issues, they're on the opposite side of this robust Saudi Arabia that's pushing its agenda. And you see them forming kind of relationships of convenience, or at least maybe beginning to take steps in that direction. And a second one is the eclipsing of certain other issues that have really driven the region for a long time, the primary lead one being the Israeli-Palestine conflict. That's an issue which you begin to see efforts to build relationships with Israel, particularly on the part of Saudi Arabia as part of the anti-Iran effort, that would have been pretty exceptional and probably fantastic seeming just a couple of years ago. A lot of that has been complicated by the president's declaration of regarding Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, recognizing as the capital of Israel from the United States perspective. But, I think one thing to watch is the extent to which Saudi Arabia continues to try and build that sort of relationship up, and the degree to which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has kind of receded as a major driver for state interests in the region.
Okay, so I think that all of the three issues that you cited as kind of focal points for American policy in the region are correct, but I think that they are all manifestations of something broader, which is the breakdown of order in this region, the state order that had dominated the region that the U.S. had largely guaranteed and sustained. And that order broke down in the wake of the Arab uprisings of 2011, the violent response that Gaddafi and Assad and other leaders in the region had to those uprisings and the civil wars that resulted. And out of that breakdown, we saw the rise of ISIS and new opportunities, by the way, for other jihadi groups. We saw the return of geopolitical competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey for control over the region because the power relationships were no longer kind of frozen. And, you know, we saw this competition over, well, who's going to decide what sort of political system Arab states are run by. And that's the debate between the sort of Muslim Brotherhood and populists and the sort of status quo or counter-revolutionary, if you want, monarchies and status quo Arab republics. So I think that all three of those phenomena are outgrowths of this broader breakdown in order. And I think the challenge for the United States, again, sort of zooming out, is that this is a region of the world that successive American administrations have come to see globally as less significant to our interests than it has been in the past. For a long time, when the United States was fighting the Soviet Union, when it was very dependent on imported energy, things like that, the Middle East was very, very important. And now it's not as important to us. And yet, this is the moment when the region is just a disordered mess. And so it's kind of dragging us in, even though left to ourselves, I think we probably wouldn't be doing as much there.
That's all there is, folks. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to all the Lawfare contributors, Scott Anderson, Susan Hennessy, Josh Blackman, and one Lawfare contributor, honorary Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, for answering questions. Thanks to all the listeners who sent in the questions. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only, Sophia Yan. You need to do your part in the new year to promote the Lawfare Podcast, so leave us that rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast distribution service you use. And, of course, this day, as all other days in 2017, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.